Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to Marriage, Divorce, or Civil Partnership, The Evidence for Integration, a presentation by Alison Pitch. It was recorded at the ADSW conference on the 20th of May, 2011.
Thanks very much indeed, and good morning. And thank you to ADSW for this invitation. Particular thanks to Peter McLeod for commissioning the piece of work on which my presentation will be based, and for chairing the group that are advising on it and hopefully will take it forward. Perhaps not so many thanks for putting me in a slot to follow John Snow. I will, however, shamelessly take the opportunity to give a plug for IRIS. If any of you need training in social media, you want to know how to use Twitter, how to overcome all the barriers that often exist, just get in touch. So there's a seamless transition, hopefully. My role this morning is not to decide what is to be done, that is for others. My role and my passion, as some of you will know, is to try and ensure that the messages and the lessons from evidence are heard, that we have evidence-led policy rather than policy-led evidence. I think it's been remarkable how often over the last 2 days there has been talk of evidence. The word seems to have come up, or perhaps just because my antennae are out for it, with remarkable frequency. Sir Peter Housden spoke yesterday of the importance of the evidenced case. Choices for Scotland based on the evidenced case, and of a Scotland that works. Likewise, on the first day, we had a variety of pleas to heed the evidence. And I would ask people, if they can remember that far back, to reflect on what we heard. Kate Hartingham, in particular, in her account of the challenges in Ireland, with its emphasis on trolleys, on waiting times, highlighted how we ignore research very often in this area, and the swings and roundabouts that often result from that. And in their case, the latest turn of the carousel moving towards the separation of health from personal social services. Indeed, by the end of day one, I reckoned others had already answered my question. But for those of you who weren't there, or for those whose recall may be a little impaired the morning after, perhaps you can consider this session as a bit of a revision class. ADSW have sought this review of the evidence around health and social care integration in order to have a sound basis from which to develop their proposition on the best way to move forward. I have been charged with reviewing the UK and international literature and the evidence from sources such as the inspection reviews, which we heard about earlier in conference. Sue Brace, who many of you will know recently from Edinburgh, she is also involved in this review and is looking at a small number of case studies of how things have evolved to date in Scotland. Let me reassure you that I'm not going to talk you through a whole long list of studies and findings. You'll need to take some of the statements I make on trust, but of course the full details and all the references and all the authors and all the counter-arguments will be in the report that's submitted. So all I want to do this morning is to try and draw out some of the key elements of the debate and to point you to some of the routes which may well lead to success, and to try and dissuade you from lots of activity in areas that are unlikely to produce successful outcomes. So just a reminder of the context for the debate. All areas that have been referred to that you're familiar with, the Christie Commission that will be reporting in June, John Arbuthnot's report on the National Care Service Expert Panel, report from Audit Scotland that we await with interest on community health partnerships, the integrated resource framework pilots in Scotland, and some integrated care pilots that are currently taking place in England. The Dilnot Commission, and of course all the major policy initiatives that create the landscape. But in the talk of the need for health and social care integration, I think we perhaps have to take a step back and ask, what is the problem that we are trying to solve? Reference has been made on a number of occasions to a pervasive air of disappointment. But I have found it quite difficult to find a more coherent articulation of what the problems are. So perhaps what I'll do is just examine a few of the headlines that sort of float in the background. Social work hasn't delivered. And I think at my age, one has learned to take a somewhat measured look at the pace of change, perhaps to think in decades rather than in individual months and years. For example, they tried to tell us that community care would never work, and yet I think one can cite some real, very, very different situations from a few decades ago. I've highlighted, and I won't read them all out, just a few of the areas where I think at the broad macro level we can feel that we have made real steps forward. And of course we had the much more detailed analysis from Alexis, which similarly refutes at a much more detailed level much of this headline. But again, as we were told earlier at this conference by Pat Payne, we are very poor at advertising these successes. Another preoccupation, and one that often seems to be the sole driver of the debate, delayed discharges are a major problem. And for those who are struggling to enter zero in their census return, this may indeed be an immediate concern. But again, to take a longer term view, over the last decade, delayed discharges have reduced from over 2,000 at the highest point to really just a handful. And hopefully that diagram makes the case. There are lots of problems with the hospital-community interface, but they are as much about unnecessary admissions, about poor arrangements around the discharge process. If anyone knows how to solve the patient transport problem, surely in this day and age we should be able to get some of these areas that have a much more immediate impact on individuals' lives sorted. Another of the myths that seems to lurk behind this debate is that it all works in Northern Ireland. And just to reassure any researchers amongst you, I've actually added the names of some authors to convince you that this is not just my particular individual views. As most of you probably know, in Northern Ireland, one provider trust covers all the primary, acute, and community health and social care. And since 2007, there have been 5 fully integrated, fully comprehensive health and social care trusts, and 4 commissioning boards that there had been prior to 2007 have been replaced by a centralised integrated commissioning board. But the reviews of that have been done, the close examination of the evidence, suggests the dominance of health. The priority tends to be given to health agendas, and in particular the performance targets that very much focus on health come to dominate. For example, reduction in hospital infection. And there is a real anxiety that social care values, social care priorities are being subsumed within these other concerns. There appears to have been a limited focus and little interest in capitalising on the opportunities that you might think that situation would give, and a real concern that the full potential of integration has not been achieved. Little focus on personalisation, on individual budgets, or even, I understand, on the detail of children's services. So they're just a few of the myths, ideas that float around that I would suggest we need to look very carefully at and not just to take as received wisdom. But before we go any further, I think we need to recognise and acknowledge some of the definitional issues in this debate. Different terms fly around: partnership working, collaboration, joint working, integration, generic workers. And much of the noise in this debate, I would suggest, is because people are actually talking about different things, or they are talking about the same thing but using different terms. I think it was Peter Hay who said earlier in the conference that integration is a pretty simple word, but a very complex concept. And I've always found it helpful, and I would suggest, commend it to yourselves, to think of this debate in terms of a continuum. I think we also need to add, if one could do a three-dimensional diagram, the dimension, the critical dimension of the partnership with the people who use support. The partnership, for example, in the co-production of her assessment that Pam talked about yesterday. But just to put a bit of flesh on those 5 stages in this particular continuum, the first one, relative autonomy, that is really where health and social care agencies are meeting any statutory requirements for collaboration, but otherwise any contact or connection is pretty informal. A step further along the continuum, coordination, there is a reasonable level of formal commitment to joint working, coordination around some areas of commissioning and of strategy. Opportunity for joint appointments, and again, there have been examples talked about over conference that fill in a lot of the detail at various points along this continuum. Enhanced partnership. This is really where people are getting pretty serious. There's a system-wide commitment, a shared vision, and integration across most of the strategic and commissioning functions. There is formal high-level backing to the enterprise, but nonetheless, the agencies remain separate legal entities. And then finally, for some, the goal, structured integration, a single integrated legal entity. There was a survey in England last year that explored the situation there. and they ask the extent to which partnership working was in place between health and social care, and what helped or hindered situations that people had experienced. The majority were not by any means at the structural end, but there was some degree of integration. And perhaps a very significant finding, for those who are finding last night's indulgences starting to wear off, it might be a point to wake up. The top factors that had helped agencies progress were all locally determined. The positives were locally determined. Local leadership, vision, strategy, and commitment. All those softer relationship aspects that are much more difficult to capture and pin down, but have a critical role. In contrast, the top factors that people described as hindering any progress along this route were all nationally determined. Performance regimes, funding pressures, financial complexity. And I would suggest that is a finding that is worth reflecting on. So, this is the point at which I try to distill the core body of evidence in a few minutes. And as well as the experience in England, in Scotland here, there are a number of well-scrutinised international examples. And just to prove I've actually looked at them, PACE in the US, CEPA in Canada, Rosarito in Italy, coordinated care trials in Australia. For any of you familiar with the discussions around partnership working, these are the instances that crop up over and over again, not least because there have been fairly detailed and long-term evaluations. And there are some clear messages that I just want to try and encapsulate, both from these health and social care examples and from other sectors. And one of the most overriding messages is that there are severe limits to what can be achieved by structural change alone. Kate, again, on the first morning, spoke of the panacea for all ills being seen as structural reform. People have to be seen to be taking a lead, and the result, as she outlined, is often continuous, discontinuous change. So there is a much greater reality if the emphasis is on service integration rather than organisational integration. If we look at the private sector, there is a lot of evidence that mergers are rarely successful. They can be very disruptive to both managers and to those receiving services, support or whatever. And they can also get in the way of positive service development. They also, for those who had hoped there was a financial carrot, they rarely appear to save money. And really, a quote that pulls all this together: policymakers should seek to create an environment more conducive to local integration by recognising that enforced structural change or instability caused by that threat are counterproductive to joint work. So we have strong evidence on the dangers of pinning your hopes on structural change. There is a related stream of evidence that links to the current focus on outcomes, and particularly outcomes for the individual. some of you may well know and be familiar with it, the traditional focus of research on partnership working per se has tended to be very much on the process of that working. How staff were getting on together, how new systems were working. It was really only in the last 4 or 5 years that people started to think about the impact of partnership working for the individuals receiving support, that they actually switched from a focus on all the mechanics of process to actually looking at outcomes. And here, the evidence is much less definitive. I think it's probably fair to say that the case remains unproven. It is not clear that partnership working necessarily delivers better outcomes for the individual. But as a good distiller of evidence, I have to put some words of caution around this particular area. And there's quite a lot of debate goes on amongst the people involved in the research, that perhaps to some extent the uncertainty is a product of the complexity. There's issues of attribution, timescales, whether you're looking just at the short term or at the long term. But really, as encapsulated on the bottom of that slide, what we need to do is drill down much more to the specifics. What sort of partnerships can produce what kinds of outcomes for what groups of people, when and how? And people are naturally disappointed when there is no certainty, perhaps particularly in this area where it may appear counterintuitive. I mean, it's very easy to assume, well, of course, if we all work together, it'll produce a better outcome. But all I can do is caution you and say that this is really an evolving field. So where do these two strands of evidence lead? Just a quick, just to put up some of the core principles that, of course, for yourselves, lie behind all this debate. Principles that have come out in the discussion, in the manifesto, and I won't read through those, they're very familiar to you, but I would just say that we shouldn't forget some of the successes and particularly the Scottish achievements around individual outcomes in the form of talking points and its developments. South of the border, people are extremely envious. And let's look also, again, perhaps to address some of the discussion that floats around there in the ether, the lessons from some of the early adopters of various forms of partnership along that continuum from south of the border. These tend to be bandied about, and the danger is that they are used as a demonstration that integration, the structural model, works. Well, I want to again suggest some caution. What is common to all the early adopters, as they're often referred to, the Torbay, Northeast Lincolnshire, Knowsley, is that they are all distinctly different from each other. They are not a one-size-fits-all. They have also emerged from a long history of integration. So, for example, Torbay, where from really quite early on, what they said up front was that the driver was of better outcomes for Mrs. Smith. They started with 5 integrated health and social care teams, aligned with GP practices, a single management, single point of contact, single assessment process, pooled budgets. And through that process, they could commission whatever was needed for Mrs. Smith. In time, that evolved into a care trust, a particular model, a legal entity south of the border, which also has elected members on its board. In no sleep, the model was very different. That was a bottom-up model, creating a new health and wellbeing partnership. And then in North East Links, that started off as a Care Trust Plus, and now actually is evolving into a social enterprise model. So there is a variety of different solutions, local solutions for local needs. And there are also examples that didn't work. Barking and Dagenham, joint appointment, integration, collapsed after 2 years because they had not considered the very different cultures that they were trying to put together without adequate preparation. Somerset, this is a much researched development of the mental health, health and social care partnership studied by Edward Peck and his colleagues, and that unfortunately showed initial reductions in job satisfaction, morale, role clarity, little change in levels of user satisfaction, and ambiguous results in terms of outcomes. So, perhaps not the nice easy message that you'd like to hear, but there is no easy answer. It underlines the need for there to be a menu of options rather than a single solution. What works in one area will not necessarily work in another. What are the differences in context, in relationships with stakeholders, and indeed in terms of local differences in preference in terms of priorities. Obviously, this message of complexity is not the one people necessarily like to hear, but there is a real danger, I would argue, if you don't listen, that you end up in a cul-de-sac, or even worse, embarking on a sort of pathway that is likely to fail. So, as ADSW moves forward into structuring its proposition, you need to think of a strategy for the optimal delivery of outcomes. It is about outcomes, not structures. As indeed we heard from Sarah in that excellent presentation yesterday, go for the innovation that meets the problem. But first, ensure that you are clear about the configuration. About the problem. Start with people's quality of life, not the configuration of the organisation. So although I would love to be able to say that A plus B will produce Y, it is a harder slog than that. It's about putting together the elements from the cookbook that will contribute to the desired outcomes. So as my final slide, I really just leave that with you as the template for you to fill in the details of how you are going to ensure that those ideals, those principles that you hold dear, can contribute to that delivery of outcomes that needs to be absolutely crucial. If you can reach the stage where there is common agreement on the outcomes that you are seeking to address, you can then move backwards to the commissioning processes that will achieve those outcomes. I would suggest that the evidence leads to locally inspired solutions, cultures, not structures, and place, not organisation. What I would just like to read out to you as final contribution is the laws. Some of you may be familiar with these. Walter Lutz's laws relating to this integration path. And his particular formulation, the continuum, is from linkage through coordination to full integration. He started off with five, and then after a few more years, experience looking at all the various models across the world, he came up with another four. So, you can integrate some of the services for all of the people, or all of the services for some of the people, but you cannot integrate all the services for all the people. Number two, integration costs before it pays. Number three, your integration is my fragmentation, i.e. it depends quite where you're looking at the particular process, which end of the task. You can't integrate a square peg into a round hole. And perhaps, very important to listen to, the one who integrates calls the tune. Then the last four that were added, don't try to integrate everything. And he has identified a particular danger of upward substitution of pooled resources into the more powerful acute care system. All integration is local. Keep it simple, stupid. I think he added that in at a certain stage of history. And finally, integration isn't built in a day. Thank you very much.